reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And remember, we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Our show today was made possible due to the generous support of Goodwill Industries of Southern Arizona. They supply services, training, and jobs to people with barriers to employment. And we thank them for their support and for all of the many things they do for our community and for the planet. Thank you, Goodwill Industries of America and of Southern Arizona. The name of our show today is Drowning in Plastic, and people that have been part of Mrs. Green's World for any amount of time know it is my most passionate subject. It's the one I like to talk about the most. Our guest is Deanna Cohen. She is the CEO and co-founder of Plastic Pollution Coalition. I might be ringing the bell a lot, Deanna. Just get ready.
Ready.
I know. The Plastic Pollution Coalition is a global alliance of individuals, organizations, businesses, and policymakers working toward a world free of plastic pollution. That is my fantasy, and its toxic impacts on humans, animals, and the environment. Deanna was inspired to co-found the group by her work as an artist because her chosen material is the ubiquitous plastic bag. She makes pretty things out of ugly plastic, I have to say it. With the Plastic Pollution Coalition, she helps to raise awareness of ocean waste, the majority of which, as we all know, is non-degradable plastic, and to provide everyday strategies to cut down on the amount of plastic we use and throw away. So welcome, Deanna. I could not be happier. It's like, this is my passionate subject. It's killing us. So let's start with the easy question of, yes, it was. You were involved in art. You're an artist. But how did you get involved on such a grand scale with your artistic background and your journey to becoming the Plastic Pollution Coalition goddess or queen?
Warrior.
Warrior, yes. Let's use warrior. I like that.
Well, I've been making art most of my life. And as a student at UCLA about 30 years ago, I initially was a biology major, and at some point I found a frustration in the fact that in the science department at that time in the 80s, it was not possible to be as creative as I felt I would like to be, and I was impatient. And so at some point I began taking classes in the art department and tried to double major unsuccessfully, and at that point made the choice to pursue art for my education, and in doing that found that I was suddenly surrounded by a bunch of people who were all thinking in a very creative way and looking at a lot of things that were going on in the sciences as well. And I think, you know, lucky me that I chose this route, because life has taken me on a path where I've come around full circle to needing to be able to understand scientific reports and peer-reviewed studies and basically understand science. And it really was through my artwork. And I've been working with plastic bags for about 25 years, cutting them up and sewing them back together. When I originally started working with them, it was not from an activist perspective at all. It was really a celebration of the colors and the fonts and the text and the images which were printed on the bags, and a lot of the properties of the bag. I mean, plastic is very compelling substance. It comes in, you know, myriad rainbow of colors.
Right.
And it's incredibly useful material. It's a material that has allowed for a kind of more than the Industrial Revolution, but allowed us to provide all different kinds of things to everyone. It's allowed us to, you know, make lighter cars and lighter transportation, airplanes and, you know, computers and smartphones and eyeglasses and all kinds of wonderful gizmos and gadgets and things that we all pretty much at this point take for granted. And if we live in a country where we don't have access to those things and we want those things, and we feel that if we have them, somehow they'll make our life easier and better. And it's been really amazing to see how plastic is, plastic kind of taken over. But anyway, I'm diverting off of the subject. But so in working with the material for my artwork, after about the first 8 years, some of the pieces that I had made, depending on particular bags that I used, began to fissure or break into smaller pieces. And at first I got really excited because I also love nature and I'm an avid gardener and love to grow vegetables and fruit and my own food since I was a little kid with my mom. And I thought that it meant maybe that the plastic was organic, that it was ephemeral like us, that it was like a flower, that it was like a cat or a dog or a pet that we love that, you know, had a finite lifespan and then would break down. And so I started exploring that, only to find out that though some plastics may break into smaller pieces, they actually don't ever go away. And
right.
They don't go back
to the
earth.
They're here with us forever.
They're here with us forever, and it's an interesting kind of transformation because I don't know if that many people listening to the program are aware of this, but most plastic is made from byproducts from processing petroleum. So most plastic is made out of petroleum, and it's made out of oil. And it's, you know, oil and petroleum are made out of animals and plants that lived a long time ago and went extinct, basically. Dinosaurs and plants that were, you know, compressed in the earth, and that's how we made oil. So, I mean, really, when you're using plastic, you're using dinosaurs, and it's a finite resource. And, you know, we use it, particularly when we manufacture, design, and make single-use and disposable items out of it, I think we reuse it in an incredibly irresponsible way. So it's the one place where I and the plastic industry agree. Plastic is a valuable material. We do agree about that. But my feeling is, why would we use it in such an irresponsible way if it's a valuable material? So that's really what we're doing when we make all of these things that are really designed with intended obsolescence, designed to be used for a minute, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour.
Right, single
and
use.
A short amount
use.
Of time and
right.
discarded. Yes.
Right. And I think to your question about people on my show listening, my listeners know, all my friends know, any public speaking I do, plastic is a petroleum byproduct. It is from the dregs of that as well. It's the bottom of the barrel. And I think the case could be made that the first plastic bag, the particulates of which never biodegrade, could be found wherever that first plastic bag started to, you know, decompose. But it's really awful. And yes, our growing listener audience knows it. But you sent a lot of really good stuff, and I try to put the Mrs. Green punch in it for what things I love to highlight. But one particular attachment you gave, I think it would be great to just go through it for new listeners and to refresh old listeners' memories. The facts: refuse single-use and disposable plastics. Start now. Bring your own bag and reusable bottle. To me, those are the two easiest steps that you can take to start living more sustainably. So one of the facts you mentioned, plastic is forever. I mean, including the small amount that has been incinerated has become toxic particulate matter. Then why don't you talk a little about plastic poisons our food chain? People, listen to her.
Yeah, so it's interesting, and I feel like even though I pursued, I originally the reason I had been studying science is because when I was in junior high school, my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer, and when I was about 17, she died of it, and it had metastasized in her body, and she had a type of breast cancer that started in her lymph nodes, and it was estrogen receptive. So it turns out that these chemicals that we use to manufacture plastic are, you know, estrogenic. They're basically endocrine disruptors. They function like endocrine disruptors in our body. Some of them have even been now identified and renamed by various scientists as obesogens. And these chemicals, what they do is they are chemicals that are plasticizers. So you may be familiar with some of the names, like you've heard, oh, it's got bisphenol A in it, it's got BPA in it, or you may have heard it's BPA-free. Well, if it's BPA-free, they may be using BPD or BPZ or a different bisphenol, which according to Antonia Calisat, who runs the Endocrine Disruption Department, she's a director of that department at the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. She said that the replacements for bisphenol A, for BPA, are equally bad, if not worse, and that they're changing so quickly in products that it's difficult for them to find the markers to identify which ones are being used. And then there's a whole other group of chemicals called phthalates.
Right.
And these chemicals, the phthalates and the bisphenols, are used as plasticizers. They're added to the carbon chain when you're making plastic in order to make it rigid, malleable, supple. If you want it to be supple or more rubbery, you add more phthalates to it. And many times these are not identified on products. They're just listed as fragrance. Phthalates are listed as fragrance. And this is when your kid is in the bathtub playing with and chewing on like a little rubber ducky, but it's not made of rubber. It's made of petroleum or some other plant-based, you know, carbon-source plastic, but with additives, which are phthalates, and heavy amounts of phthalates to make it rubbery. So these chemicals have been identified as being linked to a number of human health issues. I mean, they can't necessarily per se say that this A causes B, but they can show in studies that this affects this. So it's been, these chemicals have been linked at this point to everything from obesity and diabetes to lower sexual function, sterility, infertility, prostate cancer, brain cancer, and breast cancer. And babies exposed in utero, these chemicals have been linked to shortened anogenital distance, smaller penis size, smaller length, smaller girth, feminization of boys, so young boys getting pudgy breasts, early menses in girls, and lower IQ. Oh, and attention deficit disorder. So don't you just want to eat and drink all your food and your beverages packaged in plastic while you're pregnant with your first child? I mean, doesn't that sound just wonderful?
Yeah, the education about this. You know, no matter how many times I hear it, it makes me sick and gets me upset. And then the ultimate is it ignites my passion all over again. So you covered in the facts, I mean, plastic poisons our food chain. You very clearly articulated that. And the food we eat sometimes, if it's fish, has been, you know, they have eaten the plastic, and then we eat the fish, and then so we eat the plastic. And then you talked about the effects on human health, that harmful chemicals leached are in the bloodstream, and that the latest research, 279 toxins are found in most newborn babies' umbilical cords, and a lot of them are those plastic toxins. I mean, it's disgraceful. So what about...
That's a study that was conducted by Environmental Working Group, and they're also part of Plastic Pollution Coalition.
We love EWG here. I mean,
we've
probably had six different people on, and they're scheduled for coming up. They cover it all. I say if you want to know about what's safe to put on your skin, what's safe to eat, or what's safe to drink from, just go to EWG, and they pretty much have the answer, and you can trust them. Okay, disposable plastics are the main source of plastic pollution. Can you articulate on that a little bit? One of my pet peeves is the number of straws that are consumed in the United States every day. Just that alone.
Right.
What do you need a straw for?
Well, it's interesting that you mention that because I am calling you to be on the show from an island in the Ionian Islands. It's the most western island in the Greek islands. And this is our second year working on a pilot project we launched last year, which is called Plastic Free Island. And today we did an audit and a bunch of lessons with school children at an elementary school that has six different grade classes. And one of the things that the kids here really get excited about and understand, because we did a beach cleanup with them this morning, is that people in Greece use a lot of straws, maybe even more than we use in the United States, because they put one or two in every, you know, iced chocolate milk, frappe, coffee that people drink. There's a lot of disposable plastic going on. So, but particularly straws, and kids really like this idea when they see what's happening with straws at the beach and washing up in the water, and they understand there's a big movement here to protect turtles, which are called careta, and the turtles have a bunch of nesting beaches here where they lay their eggs. Like right now, the turtles are mating, and they're going to get ready to lay their eggs on the beaches. And but the children learn all of this from the from this Wildlife Sense group that came and spoke to them, and then they turn around and they instantly are saying no straw, which in Greek is ohi kalamaki, and the kids kind of march around saying ohi kalamaki, but the idea that if you do want a straw, you could consider investing in a reusable stainless steel straw or glass straw, glass dharma, or if you're a business owner, perhaps offering your clientele paper straws would probably be, you know, a step better than plastic straws. And in my opinion, plastic straws are just literally instant garbage. I mean, they're garbage the minute you take them out of the packet. So, and they can't be that good for you to be drinking out of when I think about it. I mean, I don't know. I have never seen any
studies
of
that. And a lot of times they just serve it to you without asking, and I say, oh, please, I don't want a straw, and if they're going to bring another one. But the number, last time I did research on it, is in the United States, 500 million straws per day are the average use per person. That's real, and you think about it, 500 million average, per, you know, cumulative.
Right.
So it's 1.6 per person is what I mean. But per day is are disposed of. I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's crazy. It's interesting, though. I mean, I know that in Florida, on Miami Beach, that those hotels were having a big problem. You know, because what you have to realize, too, is every coastal community or island archipelago, particularly ones that have hotels or inns or motels or their resorts or places that people go and enjoy because of their natural beauty, that those places have to pay people to clean up every morning in the dark before you get up and walk outside so you can see a picturesque scene. They're paying somebody to pick up all this stuff and clean it out of the sand. And I mean, why serve it in the first place?
Right.
Is my feeling about it. And Miami Beach, I guess, banned plastic straws for the restaurants that are right on the strip now at the hotels. I believe that they did that about a year and a half ago.
It's a small step. But
sure, but I mean, you know, these are just tools that people can use. So
but
I think
we
it's
all
good
have
to
kind of get on board and out of the consumer coma. Another fact on this sheet, because I decided I'm going to write my newsletter about it next week, because people have to be reminded, you fall back into those patterns. Plastic recycling is not a sustainable solution. People say to me, oh, yeah, but I recycle. What do you say to them in a nice way when they say that to you?
Well, a lot of times I ask them if they actually know what happens to their recycling, because it turns out, I mean, the most recent stats that I read were that in the U.S., we recycle less than 11% of all the plastic bottles that we use annually. And of all the plastic we use, including polystyrene, et cetera, less than 22%. And those are abysmal numbers. I mean, Germany has numbers in the 70 and 80 percentile for taking back the stuff. But I think that the idea that we're actually recycling is a misnomer. I think that what's actually happening with maybe two types of plastic is that it's being downcycled and degraded and turned into something lesser. And I think that's what's actually going on. So it is, you know, we all put things in our recycling bin and just say a little prayer and hope that somebody sorts it and something happens to it. But I'm not sure, you know, what the reality of that is. And I know for a fact that it really depends on the infrastructure of each city or town. And so, for example, I know that I live in Southern California, but I know that San Francisco and Oakland have industrial composting facilities, whereas the city of Berkeley, which is right next to Oakland and right across the bay from San Francisco, does not. So, you know, you don't have to go to a lesser developed country or even area to find a situation where there's no infrastructure to support it. I mean, recycling is a really nice idea. But that's why I prefer this model, which was the first campaign that we developed when we created Plastic Pollution Coalition in the end of 2009, and it's called the Refuse Campaign.
And that's where we're going to have to take a break.
Yeah.
I told you the time would fly. So everybody, hold that thought when we come back. The first R is reduce. Let's remember that. More from Deanna Cohen from the Plastic Pollution Coalition. Stay here with me.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the Igloo radio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmer Glass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
In the mid-Tucson summer, you would expect it to be over 100 degrees. But deep beneath the University of Arizona's compost heap, temperatures can hit 160. Started by the Compost Cats student group, the U of A Compost Project is collecting tons of waste from around campus and keeping it out of landfills. Gathering garbage and converting it into a useful product for the community? Now that's a hot idea indeed. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And today, we are asking you to think about your use of plastic. The name of our show today is Drowning in Plastic. We are very fortunate to have as our guest Deanna Cohen, CEO and co-founder of Plastic Coalition. And the Plastic Pollution Coalition is a global alliance of individuals, organizations, businesses, and policymakers working toward a world free of plastic pollution. I can only dream of that. And its toxic impacts on humans, animals, and the environment. Deanna was inspired to co-found the group by her work as an artist because her chosen material is the ubiquitous plastic bag. Deanna, thanks so much for being with us and for sharing all these facts and getting us re-inspired about plastic. I am there already, and maybe it'll help some of our listeners incorporate a few more additional habits. Before we go on to what we were talking about, to your first campaign, let's just end the one on the fact sheet about plastic pollution is not only in the ocean, but tell us how devastating plastics are to the marine life and how what kind of toll it's taking, according to NOAA. It's just really not on the plants and making the trees ugly and getting into our bloodstream. It's killing things.
Yeah, I mean, plastic is, look, the ocean is this vast body. We live on an ocean planet. When you look at the Earth from outer space, it's blue. We live on a blue planet. It's made of water. We're made of water. I think that, you know, since the beginning of mankind, we probably thought we could throw things in the water, and it seemed so big that it would never come back and bite us. But basically what's happening is the ocean is, I would say, kind of vomiting plastic out. And if you go to the windward side of almost...
It's a really good word to use.
I mean, it is. If you go to the windward side of almost any island system, you will find a lot of plastic. And some beaches, like Camillo Beach in Hawaii, the windward side of the island on the southern point, are just plastic beaches covered with tons and tons and tons and tons of plastic. And what we're beginning to see is a kind of plastic beach, and it just saddens me to imagine that this is the beach of the future for, you know, my niece and my nephew and the children in my life, that this is what they're going to have to look forward to. And there's nothing kind of more disturbing than to have to swim under kind of a thin film of broken down confetti of plastic in the Mediterranean or, you know, in the Pacific Ocean. And it's quite amazing, actually, because there's so many people that I've met who have been to very remote places, either as scientists or professional surfers or photographers for National Geographic, and they say that they just can't believe how much plastic there is in systems where no one lives.
Where there there's no human inhabitants, exactly.
No,
they're
no
out
human.
In the middle
so
really, of the ocean, and they right. are coming around and being surrounded by plastic bags. They're everywhere.
Yes, and I mean, not just plastic bags, but all kinds of
yep.
plastic items and things that may have been washing around in one of the naturally occurring gyre systems in the ocean for 10 or 20 or 30 years. So things wash up. I mean, I remember being in London last year and opening the newspaper, and there was a photograph of a yogurt container that someone had found washed up in the beach in Cornwall or somewhere, and it was from the 1970s, and it still had the price on it.
Yeah.
And it was a plastic container.
And
there are people who actually collect, like, old plastic washed-up Legos that they don't make anymore because these things just last forever. But, I mean, the more frightening thing about when plastic gets in the ocean, there are a few of the things that are frightening about it. I mean, one is that when plastic gets in the ocean, it basically functions like a kind of, almost a magnet, like a sponge for other organic pollutants that wash into the sea. And
right.
everything washes downhill and into the sea through our rivers, etc., our gutters. And so you can end up with a tiny little piece of plastic, like a little tiny ball that's a pre-consumer plastic bit, like a nurdle. You can end up with a tiny little piece of plastic like that, and it can have up to a million times the particulate, you know, persistent organic pollutants attached to the surface of it. And that includes pesticides, pharmaceuticals, flame retardants, all the chemicals that wash down into the sea. And organics stick to this stuff, and then if it's a little round ball and it looks just like a fish egg, something else comes along and says, oh, that's food, and eats it.
Or
and then
worse,
that just bioaccumulates.
I mean, yeah, eats it and gives it to
yeah.
its babies. I mean, the Chris Jordan website and Midway, his work on plastic pollution was what got my attention over 8 years ago. I just looked at dead baby albatross in the middle of the Pacific Northwest and no people around and saw the impact there. And the numbers are staggering. Your website is awesome, the Plastic Pollution Coalition, but a million seabirds. We're not talking about a little. A million seabirds, and those numbers are growing. 100,000 mammals each year, and those numbers are growing. Dead fish and dead birds because of plastic that we really don't have to use.
Well, for me, those images that Chris Jordan shot, that Wayne Sentman shot, that Susan Middleton, actually it was an image that Susan Middleton took of an albatross that she became friends with on Midway when she was doing other field work there, and then that bird unexpectedly croaked, and they did a necropsy, and the bird had over 330 pieces of plastic in its stomach, and they had named it Shedbird, and I just heard her speak about this recently, and literally we were all crying. I mean, the thing is, those birds, for me, and those images are very powerful because they, for me, those birds are a metaphor. These animals that are being affected in such a deep way in that they're dying with their stomachs full but with nothing nutritious in their stomach, they're a metaphor for us. We're human beings, and we're stuffing ourselves full of plastic and the chemicals that leach from plastics into our foods and are affecting our bodies, and we don't even know that we're doing it.
And it's literally killing us. I mean, you're right. I think that's a great point, that it is a metaphor. And you, I'd like to talk about, I never really quite got, how did you morph from artists using plastic to this passionate position of yours? And how did you step into that? I think we glossed over that. I'm like, this is great. How did she tell us already?
It's a conundrum for me at this point in time. I mean, we just installed a very compelling exhibition at the Goulandry Natural History Museum in Athens, Greece last week, and it opened on Saturday.
I did not get the invitation. I just want you to know.
Sorry about that. It was on the Facebook page.
Excuse me.
For the Plastic Pollution Coalition Facebook page. We try and post information just in case you're in that neck of the woods and you feel like coming by. But it's going to be up, I think, for 4 or 5 months, so just if you get a chance, swing by the museum. But it was an interesting show to do because the bottom floor was different European-based and Greek-based scientific organizations and oceanic organizations that are studying what's happening with plastic in the ocean. Plastic in the Sea. And then upstairs, we presented a show that with a little bit of my work and some of Pam Longobardi's work, and then several other artists who are all mainly photography-based artists, and some short videos, et cetera, things like that, but to do a kind of combination. So the show is basically a nexus of art and science, and to allow us to engage people, we hope, in, you know, a deeper and more fun way to want to learn about the issue.
And people, we've had a couple of interviews lately where they talk about how, I don't know what's going on with my throat, excuse me, how art helps to inspire people, it helps kids get engaged, that visual component really helps. So to me, if you go to the Plastic Pollution Coalition website, they're not grossly graphic, they're engagingly graphic, because I think most people really don't want to see a sea turtle eating a yellow plastic bag. They don't want to see a sea lion with one around its neck. I mean, there are so many ways to engage all of the senses, and I think that's what the website does incredibly successfully. So you're the Plastic Pollution Coalition warrior. I might hashtag that. I love it. But there are bigger projects that you're doing to have greater impact, and I'd like to talk about three of them, if we can, the plastic-free schools, and especially that one, because I, in my work as Mrs. Green, feel that schools are becoming engaged in so many ways on a bigger level, and you can affect more lives that way. And yours is a step-by-step. If you want to have a plastic-free school, here's how you go about it. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, sure. And I would say if anyone is interested in this issue, well, two things. First, one, please visit our website and just see some of the information that we provide there and link different coalition members. Yeah. And that's plasticpollutioncoalition.org. But along those lines, a group that's part of our coalition called the Product Stewardship Institute has just released, in conjunction with the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, a toolkit about how to reduce your plastic, how to do an audit to determine the plastic footprint of your college or university, and then how to reduce that. And this is something that we've been trying to convey not only to universities and college campuses, but also to elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, that you can actually take a day and count what everybody's got going on in their lunch and what's being served at the cafeteria or eateries on campus, and then multiply that by how many days you have in a school year, and, you know, actually itemize it and come up with a picture that allows you to see how much, you know, plastic pollution you're generating at your school. And then just get together with the people who do the food procurement and the administration and some of the teaching staff and any clubs on campus, and then, of course, the people who are also contending with waste management on campus, and have a real conversation with them and look for low-hanging fruit, look for ways you can reduce things. And when you do things like that, you end up, like 2 years ago, the students at Harvard banned plastic bottle water on campus. 3 years ago, or four, it was about 4 years ago now, University of California, Santa Barbara students decided to get rid of all the plastic bags at the student store. So there are things that you can do, but you need to give yourself the picture first so that you can understand what you're dealing with. But at the same time, I mean, another small campaign that we have is just the hashtag #UseRealStuff. Make real stuff.
Love it.
And
love
the idea
it.
Is that whenever possible, you know, and that's part of the whole refuse campaign as well. When you refuse something, I think that's a fun thing to do when you're a little kid. You can say, no, I don't like that. I don't want to have that. No straw with my lemonade, please. No straw in my iced tea. But what you can also do is you can say, oh, I'd really like to have a coffee. Here I am at Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf or Starbucks or some coffee intelligentsia. I'd really like to have a coffee, but I'm going to have it here. Would it be possible to have it in a real ceramic cup? Or do you have a glass mug that I could have it in? Oh, you don't? Maybe I'll splurge this time and I'll invest and I'll buy a reusable one. And I'll just use that every time I come. And what you find now is a lot of businesses are catching on and they're giving a kind of positive, monetized incentive to people who bring their own cup. And so you can save, you know, 10 cents or 25 cents on a coffee by bringing your own reusable ceramic or stainless steel or glass mug with you. And a lot of young people that I meet all the time now are into it. They carry jam jars, they carry their own straw, they carry bamboo utensils. They carry a fold-up little bag or a canvas bag with them. And these are very, very simple things. The whole trick to it is really a behavior change. So we're going for a major behavior change. And that takes time because you're relearning something. So I think it's tougher for adults to learn than it is for children who are used to being corrected and learning new things, you know, 10,000 times a day.
Right. We can start with both places. You're right. And I tell my friends, if you do this, and I actually